Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., super endocrinologist. Yeah. Today, we got a super special guest. Every guest is special, but this guy is cool. One of the best authors, I don't know if we've had any other really cool authors. I think we have a few, actually. A few, but this guy's really cool.
Red Stoltenberg. Different type of author than we normally
have. Different type of author. Yeah, we've had a few authors on, but this guy is a really awesome author. Some really, I don't know if you, I think you've been on some bestseller lists, but Brad Stoltenberg, a public health guy. We're not going to hold it against him. He's on faculty at the University of Michigan or Michigan. We're Spartans.
That's two in a row.
What is all these Wolverines? We've had Garth Davis on. He's a Wolverine too. My goodness. But Brad is right up our alley with how he talks about certain things. We all kind of stick together, the non-charlatans of the world. And he's coming out with a new book. We're going to have him talk to us all about it and kind of a little bit about him. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, fellas. It's a pleasure to be here.
How'd you get into all this stuff? How'd you get into public health? What's your deal here?
What's my deal here?
Yeah, I want to know what the deal is.
I grew up as an athlete, and I was always just completely fascinated by how to get the most out of myself. And then as I got older, that became also how to get the most out of other people. And it began on the playing field. I played football was my primary sport, but I also played basketball and baseball. And I realized at a pretty early age that what I loved about sport was, the physicality and the competitiveness. But what I really loved was the objectivity of it, how pure it was, that you train and you either get better or you don't. And you can trace that right back to yourself.
That's awesome.
And that sort of mastery and competence has been a driving force in my life. I haven't been a good athlete for 20 years. Now I'm just an armchair athlete, but I try to take that approach to everything. And what I found in my research and reporting is that it doesn't have to be sport, but when you take that kind of competence first, mastery, no bullshit, fundamentals over fads approach to anything in life, not only do you produce your highest quality work, but you tend to have like the highest quality life. You're fulfilled, you're satisfied, you're healthy. So that's my backstory. I went to study, and my undergraduate degree is in psychology and economics. My graduate degree is in public health. Very early on in my public health schooling, it became clear to me that I wasn't as interested in the absence of disease as I was in like human flourishing. And since then, I've been on this quest to try to figure out like what does it mean to live a good, flourishing life in a batshit crazy, chaotic world.
Yeah. Are you banging your head against the wall against all the crazy biohackers? I know like with some of your older books of kind of talking about the obsession versus just kind of being consistent with the basics.
Which is really up our line. Because
we love that.
My biggest thing is consistency over complexity. Everyone's over complicating things. And I feel like people get like this, like a paralysis from analysis sort of thing. I don't, at least my patients. So like I want consistency, fundamentals, but I want you to tell us why and how we can be happier in our lives too.
All right. So the one of the reasons I wrote this book for a few core reasons, but one of them is to reclaim excellence. And what I mean by that is the word excellence now gets associated with things like optimization. So having a 37-step routine, waking up at 4 a.m, taking 4 cold plunges, making sure you take a selfie of yourself taking your 4 cold plunges. Did I mention like the 49 supplements that you have to take and you have to switch from restrictive diet to restrictive diet every 24 days, like with the solstice? And there is such a deluge of elaborate kabuki that people call excellence that is so far from what genuine, heartfelt, actual excellence is. And what ends up happening is people hear the word excellence or they hear greatness and they say, that's not for me. Like, that's what all these bros are doing. And it's like, no. Like the bros are just doing like this elaborate dance. They're not actually interested in excellence. What they're interested in is selling the shit on the internet. Real, genuine, heartfelt excellence is for all of us. And its pursuit is so fulfilling. And what it actually means is like caring deeply about a worthwhile pursuit and giving it your all and doing it in a way that aligns with your values and goals. It's not perfectionism. It's not winning at all cost. It's not being super rigid about everything in your life. It's really about trying to use your innate God-given qualities, get the best out of yourself, and contribute to the world. And that's excellence in every single wisdom tradition. That's excellence across Western and Eastern philosophy. And it kind of got bastardized over the last 15 years by the biohackers, by all the bro scientists, a lot of these like self-help industrial complex gurus. And the whole first part of the book, before I get to anything prescriptive, is like, let's actually reclaim excellence for what it is. Because the individuals across domains, whether you are a physician, an athlete, an artist, an entrepreneur, an executive, a coach, the people who excel and excel for a long period of time, they're not interested in any of these fads, okay? Like right. Simple, not easy. They keep the main things the main things. They understand the fundamentals of their craft. They surround themselves with the right people and they do it for a decade over and over again. And they care deeply. They're not too cool to care. They lay it on the line. They give it their all. And like, that's what Steve Kerr does. That's what Steph Curry does. That's what the best surgeon in your town does. Like, they're not looking for these fads. And so many people are misguided and they think that there's some kind of secret or hack or quick fix. And then they get on this treadmill of chasing these fads and they're just forever left longing. And I want this book to be a corrective to that because I think it's very necessary.
I love it. So it's not super sexy and it's only sell 10 copies then if you're not.
Yeah, no, that's the problem.
Wait, with our podcast, he'll sell 12 copies though. No, seriously, this is exactly down our alley. Yes. I mean, we text every once in a while and talking about like all these people. It's really hard on the internet unless you're promising big grandiose outcomes. I mean, that's what marketing, you know, our friend Ramit, who talks about making money, the basics are so boring and you have to look over a long period of time and be consistent. Same kind of thing. I used to do get rich quick schemes when I was younger. Like, all right, I'm sure I'm going to find a shortcut. They never worked. Yeah, same thing with trying to build muscle.
Exactly.
Like they never worked. My brother, he didn't give a damn about those things, but he was very consistent, built a lot of muscle. Like, I guess I got to do the same thing. Yeah. It doesn't, you can't get away from those basic principles. So, and you are basically trying to reclaim this concept of excellence and then show people the path. Does that sound about right?
That does sound about right. And I think that while it's simple, simple doesn't mean easy.
Yeah.
And I think we need reminders over and over and over again to stay consistent and to nail those fundamentals. And then I think it's also helpful to have a reason for staying consistent and nailing the fundamentals. That's another place where people, I think, get confused is they think that excellence is a standard. So it's being a straight A student, or it's being the number one bestseller, or it's generating this much wealth, or it's 8% body fat. Whatever it is. In the book, I argue that excellence actually isn't a standard. It's a process of becoming. And the results matter, but the results are a byproduct of throwing yourself into the process. And so often what happens is we think that we want to achieve some goal and that we're working toward the goal, but the goal that we're working toward is also working on us. So if you train to become a great power lifter, in your guy's case, a great wrestler, like, yeah, that's a big goal, but the actual training of trying to be a great wrestler is shaping you into a person. And like, that's what the pursuit of excellence is about. It's every bit as much about the person you become along the way as it is what you accomplish. Now, it's not to say like, let's all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Like, there's a reason that sports have a scoreboard. You want to perform, you want to win. It's totally normal to want to attain. And equally important is pursuing it in a way that is congruent with your values and in shaping you into a person. One of my favorite quotes in the book, comes from this reporting I did with this craftsperson named Peter Korn. And I know nothing about woodwork. I'm not a woodworker, but for the book, I wanted to talk to people in all these different domains. And what he said is that for the longest time, he thought he was trying to make a table that was really durable and that just had perfect integrity. And what he realized is he actually wanted those qualities in himself. And he was using woodwork as an avenue to sculpt himself to have those qualities. And like, and this is a master craftsperson. And then the more that I talk to people who are on the path of mastery, the more I heard the same thing, which is I love my craft, but because I care deeply and I'm focused and I'm consistent, my craft loves me back.
Makes sense. How do you transition then from reclaiming the the old definition or the real definition of excellence than to kind of a prescriptive, like, how do you get people on that path? I mean, you don't have to give all the...
We can definitely talk about it. I think the first thing is, like, let's just define what it is. And I'm going to say the definition again. It's involved engagement in something worthwhile that aligns with your values and goals.
Perfect.
And both parts of this definition are really important. So involved engagement means that you're focused and you care. Okay. I think that there's also like this epidemic of nonchalance, people have called it, where people just kind of like go through the motions. They're too cool to care. But like, you're not actually too cool to care. What you are is you're insecure and you're scared you're going to fail. So it's easier not to care than to step into the arena and make yourself vulnerable and give it your all.
Yeah.
And excellence requires that you step into the arena, that you care deeply about what you're doing, and that you have intention and that you have focus. So that's the first part. The second part, something worthwhile that aligns with your values and goals. It's so fulfilling. Like, humans have this deep-seated drive to pursue goals, to strive. But we also get tricked into pursuing other people's goals, mm-hmm. or what we think we should be doing, or what we saw someone on Instagram do, or what our neighbor's doing, or what our parents or our spouse or whatever it is thinks that we ought to be doing. And you can destroy yourself to try to become world-class at something that doesn't actually align with your values, and you're not going to be a happy person. It's got to align with your values. So what I mean by that is, if you value creativity, if you value health, if you value relationships, if you value intellect, if you value wisdom, you want to make sure that the projects that you're working toward support those values, allow you to practice those values. And when you put those two things together, when you have an activity in your life that aligns with your values and you care deeply about it and you give it your all and you do it with intention and focus, that is just, it's rocket fuel for forget the like psychology. I'm going to sound woo. Like, that's what the human spirit desires. That can be setting a goal in the gym. That can be starting a business. That can be coaching an NBA basketball team, but that can also be coaching an 8U soccer team. Okay. That can be learning an instrument. That can be learning how to cook. You can take this approach to anything. It's not a standard. It's not about having the impeccable genetics and becoming world class. It's about the process of giving something your all. So the first thing is like just getting buy-in. And I think most people, when they actually hear that, they're like, yeah, that sounds a lot more appealing than waking up at 4 a.m. and making myself fucking freezing in a cold plunge because some bro on the internet told me to. Okay. So the first thing is just like really getting clear about, like, you know, I always tell these people, and listen, I have to be careful because I don't want to sound like I'm being a jerk. Like, I get it. Like, people just want to be happy and live a good life, and it's confusing out there. Yeah. So I've fallen into some of these traps myself. So like, I get it. But something that I tend to ask people is like, what's the point of your 37-step routine? Or like, you're eating this like super weird restrictive diet. Like, why? Who told you to do this? Like, why are you doing it other than to say that you're doing it? And I think that when people contrast this kind of like pseudo excellence with genuine excellence, the latter is actually much more appealing. So that's great. And then it's like, well, it's hard. So how do you actually get on this path, and how do you stay on this path? Here's where things like focus come into play, in building time and space where you can pursue something that you care about without distraction. Consistency, Dr. Carl mentioned this, like the ability to show up day in and day out, whether you feel like showing up or you don't, like mood follows action. You just have to get started. You have to practice patience. It's really helpful to have community around you. It can be helpful to have rituals and routines, but the rituals and routines, they have to work for you. You're not supposed to work for them. So there's then all these factors, and that's essentially what the back half of the book is. And I'm happy to go into any of them that you find most helpful and most interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, because obviously, you know, we want to promote the book. People should read the book. But maybe some of the major points in how we... You know, and I often think about our kids, you know,
yeah.
And
we're has-beens.
It's over. We're just there for them at this point. But, you know, so like I think about, you know, Spencer knows my son, Trey, you know, and
how old is your son?
He's 13. He's in eighth grade.
Okay.
And maybe he'll listen to this. So maybe he's listening right now. And he's like, "That dang it. I can't believe you guys are talking." And he's going to be mad at me now. But, you know, but he's very gifted at a lot of things. He's naturally good at, you know, sports. He's very athletic. He's very smart, but he also works very hard. I think very similar to, we were very fortunate with, you know, some genetic things and our upbringing and all that stuff. But I worry about, you know, like, I think he's like a very good wrestler, and I think he has a lot of potential. But I've always been very cautious about pushing too hard because he's always been borderline, you know, burning out and all that stuff. And but I want in wrestling especially, we've learned a lot about embrace the process. It's not about the outcomes. You got it. And kind of some of the things you're talking about. But how one, I want to make sure that he is doing it for these reasons and not just for me, you know, like you mentioned, you can't do it for somebody else. You know, I think it's good for him. I think other sports are good for him. I think any sports are good and other things. But how can you help translate some of these things and maybe some of your main points to anybody, especially say kids, because I feel like they may be the harder ones to translate it to, or maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
I think about this all the time because I have an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I do a lot of volunteer coaching in the community. So like I'm constantly around kids because I too think that youth sports at their best are such a force for good in the world, especially today's world. They have so many benefits of getting kids off screens and out into the real world and working through challenges and diverse environments. I also think that youth sports can be deeply broken and can totally mess kids up. Mm-hmm. So like I want to have skin in the game and actually be a part of the solution. Yeah. So a couple of things come to mind. The first is I think one of the biggest traps that kids fall into, especially kids who are naturally inclined to be good, is that they get scared to fail. Mm-hmm. So they self-handicap. So they don't try their hardest. Again, because if you try your hardest and fail, then it's like you have no excuse. It's all on you. So sometimes I see this with my own kid. He's 8. He's not listening. So I can say this, where he'll want to get into a game if he knows that he's going to have a real high probability of winning. But when some of the older neighborhood kids are out, he doesn't want to play. They're the nicest kids. It's not because they push him around, but it's right. Because he knows he's not going to be the best. Mm-hmm. So I see that a lot with kids. And I think that it's one thing to sit there and intellectualize it and tell them, like, you have to try hard. You have to step into the arena. What I try to do is I try to set an example and I try to show my son, and my daughter's 3, so she's still young, but eventually her too. I try to show them my failures every bit as much as my successes. So like I recently tried to pull a PR deadlift. I tried to pull 550 pounds and I missed the lift. And like we spent time like watching the video of the lift and like talking to my son about like how I was really frustrated and I was disappointed and I trained really hard. And maybe I could have pulled 535, but like I put 550 on the bar because I hadn't done that. And I was really curious to see if I could. So I think like really showing young people like you can try and fail and still move on from that. And that's actually really cool to try and fail. So this notion of not self-handicapping is one thing. Something else that I think is such an important concept for adults, but especially for kids that, again, are maybe more inclined to burn out because they're pushers. I have this metaphor for thinking of identity like a house. And if you've got a house and your house only has one room in it, and that one room catches fire or floods, it's going to be really disorienting. Like you got to move out of your house altogether. It's a mess. But if you've got a house in it that has more than one room, and one room catches fire or floods, then you can go seek refuge in the other rooms of the house while you resolve the fire and flood room. And I think what happens so much with not just youth athletes, youth chess players, kids who are really good at an instrument, is the only room in their identity house becomes the wrestling room or the violin room or the, you know, the math prodigy room. And then what ends up happening is failure, the consequences of failure aren't just I failed at this thing. The consequences of failure is I am a failure as a person, or like I have no sense of identity. This is why transition out of sport is so freaking hard for elite athletes, because your whole life you're in this one room of your identity house.
You're preaching to the choir right now. I'm having like PTSD from when I was done wrestling in college.
Right. So I think a way to do this is to help young people build an identity house that has more than one room. And this doesn't mean that the rooms have to be the same size. It doesn't mean you have to spend the same amount of time in each room. It just means there's got to be more than one. So if you're going to be great at something, you forget being great. If you want to go all in on something, even if you're not going to be great, even if you're a beginner, like you're going to spend an outsized proportion of time and energy in that room. I don't love the word balance because like no one that's ever lived a super interesting, satisfying life has been balanced that I've ever met. Like they're always kind of going all in on certain things. It's just really important not to leave your other interests completely behind. Mm-hmm. So in the case of your son, maybe wrestling is the main thing, but I would encourage him to stay in touch with other interests and to develop other interests too. So that's another thing that comes to mind. And then, I mean, there's so many, but I think the last thing that comes to mind is just the people that he surrounds himself, the coaches, the mentors, the teammates. The people we surround ourselves with have such an outsized impact on not only our performance, but also on our satisfaction and well-being. And it's incredible how a good culture can be like rocket fuel for a good person, and a shitty culture can make a good person's life miserable.
Mm-hmm. We could probably go into our lives, but I kind of want to, because you're speaking to the choir.
I know.
But like, instead of talking about us, because nobody wants to hear about us, why don't we talk about this in terms of our patients? So,
yeah.
For example, our patients that are losing weight becomes their identity. At some point, everybody plateaus. Like, it doesn't, I mean, you could keep going for some, but like, at some point, everybody plateaus or they'd wither away to nothing. And then they're at this maintenance level. And now, like you said, it's completely different. They're not monitoring themselves by the pounds and the scales. So what I always try to get them to do is, now it's time to focus on other things like fitness, getting in better cardiorespiratory fitness shape, doing more miles, doing it faster, getting stronger. Does that kind of follow along the same kind of lines of what you're talking about?
It does. And I think that it this is such a juicy topic. So let's talk about this. So let's say that your big project is to lose weight and you want to be excellent at losing weight. And what ends up happening is there's this saying that I'm sure y'all have heard of it, right? Get just 1% better every day. It's like very popular in self-help. Mm-hmm. And the ethos of that, I think, is great. Because to me, what the ethos of that means is you don't have to hit home runs. You just have to be consistent, show up, and put the ball in play. And over time, those little incremental gains compound. Don't go on your crazy yo-yo diet and restrict yourself to zero calories and then fall off. Like, nope, just chip away. That's great. Where it falls short is eventually you stop getting 1% better every day.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get 1% better every day when you're new at something. You actually get 20% better every day, right. And then you get 5% mm-hmm. better every day. And then you hit that plateau, which can be like purgatory. And I think at this point, the motivation has to change from the objective scoreboard, in this case, the number on the scale, and it has to be more values driven. So the motivation has to be, I want to be healthy, not I want to lose weight because I'm plateaued. I want to be healthy.
Yeah.
Or the motivation shifts to curiosity. Now that I'm in this, now that my body has changed, I want to be like really curious about, to your point, what can my body do? Do I want to start strength training? Do I want to start running? Am I going to sign up for my first hiking trip and train for that? So it's this shift, and you would know better than me because you're working with patients clinically in weight loss. I can imagine that for some, because losing weight is freaking hard, having like a hyper focus on the number on the scale can be really helpful at first. And perhaps you even need mm-hmm. that to lose weight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then it has to shift, because then that hyper-focus gets in the way of enjoying your life once you've hit that plateau. And then it's got to shift less from the number on the scale and more to, I have this body, what do I want to do with it? And how can I be really curious about what I can get out of it? And it's no different than you know, like for instance, my powerlifting journey. So I'm very fortunate. I've never struggled with my weight in a way that so many people have. But in powerlifting, it's kind of the opposite. You're not trying to lose weight, you're trying to gain weight. And, you know, I'm relatively new to the sport 6 years ago, and I'm a pretty good athlete, but I never trained seriously, and I'm getting 1% better every day. My deadlift goes from 335 to 365, 385, 405. I'm just putting those plates on.
I was going to say, that's a good deadlift. Jeez, for beginning, good Lord.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, I mean, it's like 6-5 years. So then I hit 500 pounds, okay? And that's like a big pull. I lock it out. And then what happens, though, is I don't go from 500 to 515 in the next training cycle. I just stay at 500. And now the gains are not even observable. Like, I can't go training block to training block and see gains. Now I'm just training. And it was a bit of a mind mess for me at first. And what I realized, like, I got to practice what I preach here. So the motivation shifted from adding pounds on the bar to being really curious about the sport, into just enjoying the process of working really hard and training and making sure I'm in the right environment and I'm training with the right people, and really like trying to get a feel for it. Like, what does a good deadlift feel like? You know, how can I take tension out of the bar at just the right time? And like really getting focused on those more intrinsic qualities that kept me coming back. When I was a beginner, if I would have been focusing on that stuff, I would have quit. Cause one, I wouldn't have even known what to focus on. And two, like, I needed that validation and that feedback of adding pounds to the bar. But then in everyone's journey, there's this shift. And this is true in every single thing, you know, whether it's losing weight, deadlifting a ton of weight, becoming a great doctor. I'm sure at first, like, you're just checking boxes. You can really, like, feel yourself getting better. And now after you've been mastering your craft for 20 years, like, those observable gains are much harder to come by. So the motivation's got to shift to, like, more of these intrinsic feeling things. And that's a core component of excellence, is that, like, it does shift to this intrinsic drive to just, like, explore and be really curious about yourself.
Yeah, I love it. We had to do and same thing. Now, it's not like my brother, he has a myostatin deficiency. Yeah, huge pecs.
People don't even know what you're talking about.
No,
do you really have a myostatin deficiency?
No, that's why he's weak.
I think he might.
I'd kill for a myostatin deficiency.
Well, he does. He had abs in utero and huge pecs in Latin.
Yeah, people thought I was on steroids when I was 11, and they still
think he's on steroids and he's on TRT. I'm like, no, he just looks like that. And I'm like, touch me him. Too, right? And they're always like, no, you look natural. I'm like, God dang it, you guys. But except seriously, like, calves. At this point, it's like, my brother's, he's not, and neither am I. We're not like, we intrinsically love lifting weights. And yeah, I don't.
It's our thing. It's like what we've done forever.
It's our identity. And we had a behavioral change specialist on our podcast. It's like, it's our thing. We just love it. And we, like you said, kind of curious. I try all sorts of different exercises and like feeling the way it feels. But I'm. At this point, I'm not gonna win any, you know, powerlifting or bodybuilding. I mean, I could try to do some of those things, but I just like lifting for what yeah. it is.
Well, and I like, you know, because you talk about the health, right? And so this goes back to when we talk to patients with obesity and weight loss. I mean, Spencer, you know, mentioned, yeah, they're looking at the scale at first, but I think he and I know I and publications we've contributed to in our most recent obesity guidance publication, it is all about the health. And I think we both and most doctors try to make sure people know it's not just about the scale and the numbers from the beginning, you know, and that it is all about health, and that, yeah, a certain amount of weight loss will correlate to expected health gains. But like, say for exercise very specifically, it's all about health. And that comes back to me. I mean, I like lifting. That's the exercise I like. And so oftentimes I find a way to make sure I stay on my routine, literally just for my health.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, and back to having things align with your values, I think it's important to define health, because health can mean different things to different people. So like, health is one of my core values, and I define health as being around and able to function for the people and activities I care about for as long as possible.
Yeah.
That's basically
in that definition for me, like, that's why I still do some aerobic training, is because I'm misguided, but I think like it's important for my heart to just like touch that. But yeah, that's because I care about health. That's not because I'm going to be an endurance athlete or I want to be an endurance athlete. It's very different than a value that I bring to my writing, which is like mastery. Like, that's actually a craft I want to master. I enjoy powerlifting. I like what it lets me practice. I like how concrete it is. I like the gym environment. But like you, Spencer, like, I'm not winning, you know, forget world championships. I'm not winning state championships. I'm not winning my city championship. I'm just trying to get strong because I like the applying the things I write about in that small container. But it's ultimately, it's got to be healthy for me. Whereas with writing, it's like, I want to be the best writer in the world. That's a craft. And I think that you can have these different values and it's okay to pursue them differently and also to have different relationships with them at different points of time. I mean, when y'all were both competing, my guess is you weren't training for health. You were training to be the best in the world, best you could be.
Right.
And then it shifts. And kind of like the numbers on the scale, like, you've got to learn how to make that shift.
Could you contrast excellence versus mastery then?
I think they're very similar. I think that the mastery to me sometimes has a little bit of a harder connotation. So it's really about like technical skill. Mm-hmm. And mastery is a core component of excellence. There's an entire chapter on mastery. But to me, excellence is broader because it really has like this, what scientists would call affective, like a feeling tone to it. When you just feel like I'm deeply satisfied because like I'm giving something I care about my all. So to me, mastery is like a technical component of excellence, which is broader, but it's splitting hairs. They're very similar.
Okay. I'm trying to, you know, put these into my own world of some
sort.
But
I think that part of the reason, back to weight loss, I think part of the reason that weight loss can get so addictive for people, I think that and again, y'all are the experts here, so tell me if I'm wrong. I'm shooting from the hip. But in my framework of thinking about excellence and mastery in today's world, I think that there's so much subjective, wishy-washy, contrived stuff out there. Whereas when you lose weight, it's so objective and concrete.
Yeah.
Like it's actually one of the few areas in life where you can be like, I worked really hard. I made myself uncomfortable. And now the scale doesn't say 284, it says 279. Mm-hmm. And that is so satisfying. And especially if you're like a corporate person or an accountant whose job, you know, whether or not you did a quote unquote good job is contingent on office politics and what your supervisor thinks and the mood of the client that day. That is in stark contrast to like the scale used to say 284, now it says 279. And I think that there's a real addictive quality to that kind of concrete progress. And I think that in the case of weight loss, you can harness that for good until eventually it becomes dangerous and gets in the way. And I think that's true in a lot of things.
I love it. That makes sense. Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, in terms of business. So yeah, we went from being, you know, good athletes, then we went to med school and it was like, all right, let's try to take our competitiveness and put it into studying to be a doctor and being as good as we can. And we kind of done that. Now my brother is the greatest doctor that walks the planet, so we can't get any better. But I jest. Now we do a good job. But now I try to do it with entrepreneurial like business stuff. I was not good. I've gone through so much, and now I'm decent at it. I'm just
now
still
you have
trying
a monocle on your eyeball.
Yeah, now I have a bag of money with a the numbers and the money symbol on it and a nice Bentley or whatever. No, I don't have a Bentley. But
no, you don't.
But and I'm seriously,
you'll get appointed to Health and Human Services if you've got a Bentley.
Yeah. but seriously, like you said, the journey of it, it's just so interesting because like at the end of the day, if I sell a company or make gajillions of dollars, that's nice. It's a nice outcome, but it's really like just working towards improving. It's just it's an interesting way of thinking about
it. It has to be because that's like that is the ultimately like that's the thing that lasts.
Yeah.
Because we know from tons of psychological research, like pretty good rigorous research, that achievement just doesn't fulfill us. Like it's a trap. We think it does, but like the arrival fallacy is real. You never arrive. And that's just how humans are wired. Like we're not wired to be content. You know, think about it. All the primates on the savannah that got content, they died when there was a famine. So they got selected out. So like our DNA was passed down to us from like the strivers that were just like always on to the next thing. Cause that's how you survived in a brutal, prehistoric environment. So I don't think we should try to be content. I think that the answer is like, you've got to enjoy the hard work, you know, the work is the win in a lot of these things. And I think even applying it to your patients that are listening, something like weight loss, like, yeah, you're doing it for health. You want to be around, you want to be able to function. But when you frame weight loss is taking on a big challenge that's shaping your character and not in a moralizing way, like being fat or obese or whatever the proper term is these days is like bad. I'm not saying like that. I'm saying like you are trying to do something really freaking hard and uncomfortable. And you are challenging yourself and you're going to have to learn how to hold yourself accountable while at the same time having tons of self-compassion. And you approach weight loss like that. Like, what's it going to teach me about me as a person? I mean, to me, like that's what gets me excited because the numbers on the scale, great. You know, maybe you live a couple years longer. That's huge. That's really important. But you're also going to learn so much about yourself through the process of taking on this big challenge. And I think like there's so much value in that too. And that to me transcends any number on a scale and is equally as important.
What if you stepped into being basically a psychologist for my brother who doesn't think he's ever going to be content, which you just said is not the goal.
This is very.
Because I have it with my business. Yeah. I feel like I'm working
that
for
will make me feel content knowing that I don't have to feel.
Just
content.
don't. Yeah. Give up on it. Like seriously.
It's not going to happen.
And it's never like nothing you achieve is going to make you content. And on the one hand, you could say, oh, that's despairing. And I hope I'm not putting you in a despair cycle. That'd be a very bad armchair psychologist. But on the other hand, it's extremely empowering because then what it allows you to say is like, F it. I need to pick goals that I'm going to enjoy pursuing because I know that whether or not I succeed, I'm not going to be content.
Yeah.
So it's really freeing. Like I have a book coming out right now. I hope everyone listening buys the book. I think it's great. I really want to hit
everyone buy the
book. I really want to hit the New York Times bestseller list. It would be great. Right. And I care about it. I know that if I hit that list, I'm going to be content for about 2 hours to 6 hours. And by the time I wake up the next morning, I'm be like, what can I do to sell more books today? What's my next project going to be? Yeah. So it's not, I'm not going to go to a monastery and check out. I'm not going to lie and say, I don't care about making the list. I want to make the list. I just know that I deeply have accepted in my bones, it's not going to make me content. So I better freaking enjoy the process of going for it. And if I don't enjoy the process of going for it, then I need to pick another thing to go for.
So, okay. So, I've talked to NFL, my buddies that are in the NFL, like get out of the NFL, and they're coaching and they're working on that, but they have other friends that just, apparently it's like a really big deal in the NFL where they are not athletes anymore and they don't know what they're going to do in life. And that we kind of went through some of that with wrestling. It's kind of like, holy cow, like this is what we were working
more
towards.
Of that identity issue. And one of my best friends who was on the track team at Michigan State, he and I talked about this all the time. It was like our identity. We were stars of the teams at Michigan State. And then it was like, well, now we're not. Oh my God.
Yeah. And the better you get, the harder it is. Cause it just becomes more of your identity, the better you get.
So then what's the same kind of thing? You find other stuff or.
Yeah, I think it's really, I think transition out of sport is really hard. I think this is hard for entrepreneurs who sell their companies or whose companies fail. This can be hard for a certain type of physician. I'm painting in broad strokes. It seems like it's most in surgeons who just make their entire life their surgical practice and then they retire. Or worse, their group tells them that you just don't have the hands anymore because you're 74. These transitions are hard. And I think part of that is just the cost of caring deeply and giving something your all is that the transitions are going to be hard. In some ways, it's going to break your heart. I think that how can you try to prevent this? It's back to the identity house. I would go tell, younger Carl when you're wrestling, like it can be 98% of your identity, but like you got to keep 2% open. And clearly you did because you didn't fail out of school and now you're a physician. Right. Like, so it worked out of you. I mean, the transition's still hard. But I would argue that for a national class athlete, you probably did better than most because a lot of national class athletes, they transition out of sport and then they don't know what to do and they don't have that high and that intensity of sport. They don't have the structure of training. So what ends up happening, you find alcohol, you find gambling, and like life can degrade pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So I think the prevention is building an identity house, making sure you don't leave your entire sense of self behind. And then I think the treatment is to take those qualities that made you great at the thing that you did and find other areas that you can apply them to.
Yeah, it's great.
I like to think, Spencer, that we did that. And I think, credit to mom and dad for making sure we were well-rounded, and hopefully we can do the same for our kids and our patients and kind of keep promoting. It's still not easy. But we do a lot of other things. Yeah, I mean, sailing's my summer sport, played football and, had fun doing that. And now we're trying different things with our medical practices and in our own different ways that we have that I think I think that's keeps us going.
And I think you can still be, in the case of sport, you can still be an athlete. So I was never as good as you guys at sport. I could have played D2, D3 football. I decided just to go to a big school. So I was a good high school football player, but I wasn't going to the NFL. And when I transitioned out of football for college, I went to University of Michigan, and this is like Michigan in their prime, long before the shit show that it is today. And I couldn't go to a Michigan football game. Oh. Couldn't be in the stands.
When did you go?
In Michigan from 04 to 08.
Okay, similar time. Okay, very similar.
Laughter came out. He was there when Appalachian State.
App State. That was tough. Yeah, but I wasn't really a fan of the team because I couldn't be in the stadium because it just hurt too bad. So I could be a fan. I could be a fan of NFL players because they were like superhuman. To me, I was like, might as well have been watching WWF wrestling. But Michigan, I'd see an outside linebacker blow a coverage, and I would have made that play. Like, I was close enough. They were much better than me. Mm-hmm. Not delusional, but I was close enough where, like, I saw all my peers, like, losing their mind about this football team. And I'm like, how do you care so deep? Like, I want to be in the huddle. So I couldn't go to a game. And then I fell in love with endurance sports. And my identity shifted from being a football player to an endurance athlete. So while all my friends were tailgating, getting drunk before Michigan games, I started training to run marathons. And I did that for 10 years. I got really good. And then I developed something called chronic exertional compartment syndrome. Oh, in my calf. Geez. I had a fasciotomy. Wow. I did everything I could to try to avoid it, but it didn't work. And that was a huge identity shift. And I remember when I finally kind of threw in the towel, I'm just like, it's just not worth it. I've got a son now. Like, I'm spending too much time trying not to be hurt, and I'm always hurt. For the doctors listening, what happens is in my left calf, especially, I had recurrent stress fractures in my calcaneus and my heel, and we couldn't figure out why. And eventually I started getting like my calf would just feel like a balloon. Yeah. And it got diagnosed with compartment syndrome and realized like I just had zero blood flow to my foot. And I didn't realize it because I was a dumb 28-year-old who was pushing hard. But like I would end workouts and my foot would be like a cold piece of meat. So there's just like no blood down there, which is not, yeah, I guess, a good condition for a bone.
No.
So I had a fasciotomy. I hoped it was going to work, and it just like it didn't. It, marginal relief, but like I couldn't run without really making myself miserable. But it's a long-winded way of saying when I stepped away from running, there was like a month when, and I wasn't even good. Like I was trying to qualify for Boston. Like I was not, you know, I'm not qualifying for the Olympics here. It was a huge part of my identity. And there was the first month where I would see other runners and I would get a shot of anxiety throughout my whole body. Because I'd be like, oh, I'm not that. Like, what am I if I'm not that?
Mm.
And then after a month, it kind of dissipated. And then I took up powerlifting. And I guess talking to you guys, what I'm realizing is throughout all of that, like, I'm an athlete. That's in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
But how I apply that, that now I'm on my third chapter. And there's no way I'm going to be trying to deadlift 600. I'm not Lane Norton. I'm not going to be doing this till I'm 60. So at some point, that will shift too. And I think that that's okay. But it doesn't mean that those transitions aren't hard and anxiety provoking and sometimes can lead to transitory depressions. All those things can happen. And I think that's like, that's just the cost of caring about something and trying to get really good at it.
Yeah, that's excellent, man. You have a great outlook on everything. You clearly got a good head on your shoulders. And that's why you're practicing your groundedness with your other book, in The Master of Change. And then this book is The Way of Excellence. And it's coming out when?
Comes out January 27th. Right. So I hope that you all found this conversation interesting, and I think it's a good book.
We're going to time this out.
Yeah.
Well, when people are listening to this, I hope it's like right when it comes out. We're going to try to time it up
to do that.
So hopefully.
Great.
And so where will they be able to get it?
Amazon or something?
You get the book anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshot.org. I will say the highlight of my professional career, truly as a writer, is Steve Kerr, coach of the Golden State Warriors, is one of my role models. I think he just embodies this kind of values driven excellence.
Yeah.
And I got connected to him. It was terrifying. Talk about like stepping into the arena and being scared to fail. Sent him a copy of my book. Didn't hear back for 2 weeks. I'm like, oh, he probably doesn't like it or he got too busy. And then he wrote me the nicest email, like that he'd read the entire thing with all these comments. And he's like, I love this book. So Steve Kerr liked the book. You might like it too.
I saw some of his commentary on it.
That's so cool. Oh, very cool. Yeah, everybody, the link, we'll put it in the show notes. I'll be sure to share it on Instagram as well when the time comes. But The Way of Excellence by Brad Stolberg. Thank you so much. It was great conversation. I love it. Learning a lot, feeling good.
Probably Nadolski boys, keep doing your thing. There's a lot of grifting charlatans out there, and I just think that like more than ever, we just have to like keep beating the drum of sanity and fundamentals and caring and honesty and truth, because someone's got to do it. And I know it can feel lonely and dislocating at times, but I appreciate you guys both. Continuing to fight the good fight.
Thanks to you, man. Thanks to you. By the way, if you're listening, be sure to rate us, give us all the super high stars, 5 stars if you can. Helps us in the rankings, all that. If you don't like us, don't say anything. All right. Here's our outro.
Godspeed.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.